Welcome to Gay Mystery Authors with Brad Shreve, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talents in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. Plus, Justine Adamek is here with her weekly recommendation.
So are you ready to begin?
I am ready to begin.
Well, that's good because we're already recording, Justine.
Oh, there you go. Good thing I didn't say anything too horrible.
What do you have for us today?
I have got a book that I found to be a surprise. It's called The Siegfried Contingency, and it's written by Stephen Laskin. This came out in late December of 2018, and I picked it up off the new release list. I didn't know anything about him or anything about the book. I hadn't heard anything. And since then, I haven't seen anything about him. He hasn't written another book. And I just think this was a delightful book. It's set in the 70s, and it has a bookstore owner, Carl, his partner, Paul, just died. He's left the bookstore. He's kind of in this apartment. And then his aunt dies. So all of a sudden, one day, some bad guys show up at the bookstore and threaten him and ask him for what he has. And he has no idea what they're talking about. And then it turns out that he goes to collect on his aunt's estate. She's left him some book, which he's suspicious about. It's Faust in the original German. And it turns out that his uncle had smuggled it out from the Nazis out of Germany. And his aunt has hidden it away. And now he knows that there's something suspicious because there's all these people after it. But he doesn't know what. He's not sure who he should turn to. At some point, he starts dating the cop who investigated the initial attack. And then it turns out that the cop is not who he appears to be. And it gets an intriguing recommendation. So the puzzle is, do you know how in Raiders of the Lost Ark, there where they created an ark and they created the Nazis and was sort of loosely based on the facts of the Nazis, the legends about how the Nazis were looking for occult treasures, but the details were all made up?
Absolutely. How could I forget the melting faces?
That's right. And it's a pretty good story. And the story that he's created here and what the Siegfried Contingency is, as he goes deeper into it, he discovers that the Siegfried Contingency is the name of a plan that the Nazis had. And I can't tell you more than that because it would just spoil the fun. I've probably already told you too much and I'll have to kill you later.
Well, no, we definitely don't want to spoil the fun. And no. I got to tell you something I like about you. You didn't know anything about this book, but you saw it on Amazon and you took the risk. Yeah. And for our readers out there, that if you're reading the same author that you love, keep reading them, but take some risks now and again and try somebody else. You might be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. One of the things I like doing about this every week is, we get to talk about some of the authors that people ought to know and then you find these little gems out there that, people ought to buy. I suspect that if a lot more people bought this book, this guy would write another book, and he really ought to write more books.
You know, that's true, because I wasn't expecting my first book, A Body in a Bathhouse, to do that well, being new on the market. And I was so pleasantly surprised that my next one is on the way. So sometime early 2020, the second story of A Body in a Bathhouse will be coming out.
And readers really need to know that authors like that feedback. And somebody who's writing in the evenings while they have a full-time job may not want to do another book if they're not hearing back from the readers.
Sales help and reviews help.
Yep.
So if you like them, do both.
Yep. So this one got a sale for me, a review for me, and now I'm giving it an intriguing recommendation on our show.
Intriguing, I like.
Mm-hmm.
Anything this week from Requeer Tales for us?
Well, one of my partners, Matt Lubbers-Moore, who was a guest on this show, he did an interview earlier in the year with Big Gay Fiction Podcast, and they are airing that interview on this week's show.
I saw that he's on. I haven't had a chance to listen to it, but I definitely will.
And if people want to join the Requeered Tales mailing list, if you go to our website at requeeredtales.com, there's a link at the bottom of the homepage for the mailing list.
And the one last thing I'm going to add is if you want Justine to review your book, send us a copy in a Mobi file, info@gaymysteryauthors.com, and she will take a look and maybe you'll end up on the air.
That's right.
We haven't said that enough lately.
No, we haven't said that enough lately. And some of the books I've reviewed have come through those submissions.
Is anything else for us this week?
No, I think we're fine. It's the beginning of the year and everybody's diving back into the routine. And I'm going to be back with several more months of great reviews for you.
Well, I've got an interview coming up that I will say is nothing short of fascinating.
I can't wait to hear it. This is someone who has consulted on many of my books that I have read and loved.
And he was a former police officer and an LGBT liaison for the police department. Mm-hmm. And he has some stories to tell. So hang on tight. You'll enjoy it.
Sounds great. Always looking forward to that real crime angle.
Yes. Well, we'll see you next week.
See you next week, Brad.
We're sponsored by Requeered Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage, one book at a time. Check them out at requeeredtales.com.
My guest today is Brian King Sharp. Brian has over 16 years' experience as a police officer and law enforcement administrator. He has an in-depth knowledge of street police work, investigations, and crime scenes. He began his law enforcement career as a juvenile corrections officer in a maximum security level 5 detention facility in Georgia. Brian left that facility to pursue his dream of being a big city street cop with the Atlanta Police Department. He's with us today because he now provides specialized consulting services for crime fiction officers. Not only that, but his background is more fascinating than my brief introduction will allow. Interesting enough to have an article written about him in Newsweek in 2015, which is the same year he was invited to the White House by the Obama administration. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It sounds impressive, and we have a lot to talk about.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, let's get started by just having you give me a little more of your law enforcement background.
Okay. I started as a youth detention facility officer, as you mentioned in the introduction. I started that job knowing that I wanted to be a street cop eventually. That was sort of like a launching pad for me to get me into law enforcement. I became a certified law enforcement officer in 2000 and started there as a youth detention officer working in the pods with the kids. We were a 100-bed maximum security detention facility, and I started working back there and moved up rather quickly. I was promoted several times, actually, before I went through the 6-week training program that you had to go through at that time to become a certified JCO. I was promomoted to JCO 2, I believe, before I went to training, and then came back from training, made sergeant, lieutenant, captain, became the chief of security after a couple of years. I was over all the security officers, and then I was eventually the director of operations for the facility before I left there.
And I take it these were not the easiest kids to work with.
No, it was definitely a challenging job. It was one of the most fulfilling jobs I've ever done, but it was tough. You're taking kids that are raised in horrible backgrounds and frankly horrible lives, and some of them end up doing some pretty bad things, and they end up in a facility like that with people like me who are trying to make a difference.
So, and then what was your next step? You were about to tell us.
Yep, I decided I was not getting any younger. I was in my early 30s, and you know, that little voice in the back of my head kept going that, you know, I wanted to be a police officer. I wanted to be a cop. I wanted to be out on the streets making a difference. And I started looking around at other departments. I applied at several departments, but as a gay guy, openly gay with a partner at the time, it was very important to me to seek out a place where I could be myself. You know, honestly, the entire career that I had at the youth detention facility, I was not out. It was not something that, you know, nobody really talked about that. You know, nobody really, it really wasn't a place for that. But I made a conscious choice not to really bring that to work at the time. And I really regretted that because that's not who I am. I wanted to go and further my law enforcement career with the understanding, first and foremost, with myself, and then obviously anybody who employed me, you know, that's a big important part of my life. It's only a small portion of who I am, but it is an important part of my life. And I want to be able to be open and honest about who I am while at work. And that's how I landed at the Atlanta Police Department. When I started doing the research into the departments that I was applying for, obviously Atlanta was a huge city, lots of opportunities. But the main thing for me was, as I looked, and they were one of the few departments around the Georgia area where I was from, or at least willing to relocate to, that had an LGBT liaison actually full-time on the department. So I kind of figured if they had that, then they wouldn't have a problem with one of their 2,000 plus officers being me and being an openly gay guy. So, and I was not wrong about that. So that's how I ended up and selected Atlanta Police. I applied and they ended up selecting me, and the rest is history.
Well, now, despite the Atlanta Police Department sounds like generally being gay friendly and having an LGBT liaison, there was an event that occurred in 2009 in an Atlanta bar that changed your life. Not many people may know about it, but could you tell us what happened at the Eagle Raid?
Sure. You know, I've told the story about what happened at the Eagle a lot of times in my career, because not only did I go to work at the Atlanta Police Department, and I say some of what happened at the Eagle probably had to do, well, had a lot to do with how I ended up being selected by the chief and the mayor to represent the police department as an LGBT liaison for the department. But the Eagle Raid was not in and of itself some sort of, I don't know how to put it. It wasn't a problem with the gay community. It was bad police work. It was poor planning and bad police work that led to the raid on the Eagle Bar. But basically, in a nutshell, there was some anonymous tips that some illicit activity was going on inside the Atlanta Eagle down on Ponce de Leon Avenue. If anybody's been to Atlanta, you've probably driven past it. It's near the Krispy Kreme. That's a good move. A landmark to remember where the Eagle is. But there was some allegedly anonymous tip came in about some illicit activity, sex activity, drug activity, that kind of thing going on inside the bar. And I'm paraphrasing here. This is not exactly how it went with the investigation, but here are the nuts and bolts of it. Undercover police officers went in to check out the inside of the bar. They came out and reported to their supervisors that they witnessed illegal sex acts going on inside the bar and possibly some drug activity. Well, the decision was made to carry it a little bit further. And initially, no more investigation was done at that point. It was just kind of decided to move forward. And the ball started rolling. Ended up, there was a raid on the bar. I don't know, some weeks, maybe months later. The decision was made by someone higher in the command staff that there should be a raid done on the bar.
So this didn't happen right after they stepped in and took a look around. This happened much later.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. There was some time that passed. They came out. No arrests were made at that point. These guys came back out and reported what they had seen. Of course, they were undercover. They were in street clothes. These were detectives. And they came out and said, yeah, we saw these things. And then somebody above their pay grade decided that they would orchestrate a raid. So at that time, there was a unit called the Red Dog Unit. It was a very aggressive street level, like hand-to-hand drug type transaction squad that went out and enforced those kind of laws on the streets of Atlanta. There were some members of VICE, obviously uniformed police officers, I think two or three wagons, transport wagons. If you've been arrested, instead of going in the back of a car, you go in a transport wagon. They all show up outside the Eagle. They make entry into the bar. They put everybody on the floor, gunpoint, everybody get down. They systematically go through the bar. there was an apartment. There is an apartment upstairs over the Eagle where the bar manager, who was off that night, resides. And they actually went up into his residence. And after going through this process, everybody was systematically searched. Everybody was, as their IDs were pulled out, and they were let up one by one off the floor of the bar. They were let up and their names were ran and they were released one at a time. These are the patrons that were being released. This went on for, I estimate, a couple of hours that it took to go through this. There were quite a few people there.
Wow.
There were several arrests made, including Robbie, the owner of the bar, his partner. I believe the manager of the bar was arrested, and one of the servers, if I'm remembering correctly, I think there was four arrests made. There was no illegal drug activity found. Nobody had illegal drugs in the club. There was no illicit sex activity. The people that were arrested, I believe, if I recall, on some sort of a permitting violation inside the club, a very minor offense. And oh, by the way, all that was done without a warrant.
That's what I was going to say. I'm not an expert, but this doesn't sound like a legal raid.
Yeah, that was the unfortunate part. Nobody followed through. And that's why I was saying it wasn't necessarily because it was a gay bar. They were following up on a tip, which happens often in law enforcement. The main problem with the whole scenario was that there was no warrant obtained. Mm-hmm. So basically everything that happened from the time they walked into the bar until the time the case was resolved was due to illegal search and seizure and the whole nine yards. And patrons did come out and say after the raid that there was a lot of homophobic slurs and very inflammatory things that were being said while they were on the ground by some of the Atlanta police officers, not all, but some that were walking around in the club that night. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, none of them were identified because everybody was laying on the floor and couldn't see their faces. So, but after that happened, there was a huge backlash in the community, as you can well imagine. It's very similar to the raid of the Rainbow Lounge out in Austin, Texas, if you're familiar with that. The difference in the Rainbow Lounge and the Eagle raid was that nobody was actually hurt. Somebody was physically hurt by the police in the raid of the Rainbow Lounge. But I say all that to say that there was backlash and uprising in the community, and rightfully so. They were very upset that Officer Harris, who was the LGBT liaison at the time, was not notified about this raid. So she was not able to be on scene. She was not able to, you know, maybe intercede in some way and maybe even stop that from happening. Who knows? You know, hindsight's always 20/20. Mm-hmm. But after that happened, the mayor at the time, newly elected mayor, Kasim Reed, made the promise to the LGBT community that he would appoint two full-time LGBT liaisons to the police department. And I was fortunate enough to be the person that was selected for that in 2010, when I was appointed to the position. And one of the first things I did after being appointed to that position was drive out to the Eagle Bar and sit down and have a conversation with Robbie Kelly, who was the owner of the Eagle. But we subsequently became very good friends, and just asked him what happened that night and tried my best to do everything I could to rebuild that relationship that was honestly very strong between the Atlanta Police Department and the community before that happened. And, you know, like I said, we actually, it's funny that Robbie Kamina, a writer director, actually ended up doing a documentary film about the raid at the Rainbow Lounge. And he brought that to the Atlanta Film Festival, and I had the wonderful opportunity of him calling me up and meeting me, and I got to go to the screening. Because of the raid at the Eagle being so similar, they invited Robbie and his partner out, who were the owners of the Eagle, and it got a little heated in the – I remember taking questions from the audience after they had screened the film, and they were getting a little upset, you know, about what they had seen, and that issue that we'd had in 2009 with the Atlanta Police Department. And Robbie, the owner of the Eagle, actually stood up in the crowd and defended me and the department and spoke very highly of the work that we were trying to do to mend that that tear in the fabric of that relationship with the community. So I was, that was one of the proudest moments I had in that position was, you know, to have somebody like Robbie stand up and speak highly of what we were trying to do with our training and the things I was developing in that position. It meant a lot to me.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yep. That's the raid on the Eagle Bar.
So, so you became the liaison for the Atlanta Police Department with the LGBT community. Yes. What did that entail?
A great deal of it was just community relations, just going out and talking to people, you know, in the community, building that trust back, you know, listening to their concerns about what they were seeing with their local police officers, what they were seeing on 911 calls, you know, how were they being treated? The other huge part of the job was we were one of the few departments, and they still are one of the departments that track all the LGBT related hate crimes that take place. And that was one of the main jobs that I had was any hate crime or suspected hate crime that was committed against an LGBT person in Atlanta that came to my desk. I personally followed up with that victim, and I worked with them and the other investigators in Homeland Security to actually see if it rose to the level of actually being a hate crime, and then making sure obviously those people got any of the services and follow up that, that they needed from the police department. But one of the biggest things that I did was the first couple of months of being in that training, we were a huge metropolitan police department in, you know, arguably the top three most populated LGBT cities in America at the time. And we had zero training related to the LGBT community for the police department. So I went to my chief and I said, look, I'd love to develop some training and start training our police on how to deal with situations that they may not face every day in their regular life, right? Not everybody on the police department is part of the LGBT community, so they may not know some of these little nuances and things that would make a simple encounter on a traffic stop go much better with somebody from our community. And so I did. I developed the first training that the Atlanta Police Department had ever had in relation to LGBT diversity and hate crimes training. So I developed that training, and within the first year being in that position, I had personally trained every single one of the around 2,000 uniformed police officers, and we had probably 400 to 500 civilian employees at that time in the police department. And during the in-service required 20 hours of training that they have to go through to maintain those certifications every year, I incorporated about an hour-long class on LGBT diversity and hate crimes training.
Wow, that's impressive.
It was a lot of work.
One of the reasons I wanted to bring you on the show is we have quite a few writers that talk about individual conflicts that go on within the police department related to LGBT issues and with the community. Mm-hmm. And you hear people say, well, you know, this is outdated. This sounds like it was the 1980s. This isn't 2019, this, the way this story is written. And as you and I know, police officers are like anybody. They're all people. And you're going to have different personality types. And so these kind of things, even though it may not be a regular thing, prejudice still occurs and exists.
Sure.
A writer that does write about a situation like that isn't necessarily way off base in what they're talking about.
Yeah, I can see that. I personally never experienced that at the police department. You know, locker room talk, people tell jokes. You know, I used to joke in the training classes that I would do, rightfully, because I'd heard a couple of gay jokes. Most people on the department didn't know I was gay when I started. It just wasn't, you know, nobody comes in. And I used to joke that I didn't clock in and do the three snaps in a Z formation. So, and if nobody asked me if I was gay, they might not have known, you know, but certainly if they ask, I told them. But, you know, I always said, you know, some gay jokes I heard, I'd laugh at because I thought they were funny, and some I didn't. And that was true. You know, sometimes, you know, cops get a little, if they don't know about me and they're saying something that's disrespectful, I felt like I had the obligation to first go to them and say, hey, dude, that's not cool. You know, I happen to be gay. And that would usually change things automatically. But that's literally the worst thing that ever happened. And it's been some years now, so I can't even remember a specific joke or somebody making a specific comment, because for the most part, I just didn't see it. And my partner was my now husband was a 5-year veteran of the police department. I was there for 10 with Atlanta, and he was there for 5 of those 10. And we were just one of the guys. I mean, that's just how we were, you know. Some people's experience may have been different. I just fortunately did not have any negative experiences on the job. But I did talk to officers from other jurisdictions around Atlanta. I would run into people that did not have that luxury at work, which really saddened me. And that's one of the things I did with our training, was try to take it to other municipalities for free. I trained the Georgia Tech Police Department. I trained the Georgia State Police Department at 2 of the biggest colleges in the area. I've been to Athens Clark County, and I trained the police department up there on their campus at UGA. And I subsequently did training for the U.S. State Department and the Department of Justice, because everybody needs that training. It's just something that most people don't have. And hopefully with that training and those classes, people are way more aware of the fact that, hey, everybody I work with is not straight, right? There are people who have different backgrounds. They do the same job and put on the same uniform. They just might go home to a different person than I do every night. But we all got to work together. We all got to be respectful. And, you know, there's a huge trans community in the Atlanta area. And that was one of the main focuses. Before I left the police department, and before I left the LGBT liaison position, I wrote the first transgender interaction standard operating procedure that the police department had ever had. Simple things about how to address somebody the way they're presenting, and not necessarily what's on their driver's license. Simple things like that on a traffic stop that can make a huge difference in that interaction with a trans person who may not have fully transitioned, you know, just things like that made a huge difference. And the police officers that I trained and I worked with around our department and other departments, and even subsequently literally around the world, as far as El Salvador, I've done training for the State Department. They're very thankful of that information, because otherwise they'd have never had it.
Well, that's really impressive. They sent you down to El Salvador on behalf of the State Department. That really actually blows my mind a little bit. And I got to say about
it blew mine too.
I got to say, as far as Atlanta goes, I'm not surprised that you said it wasn't a huge problem with the department. As a youth, I spent a lot of time in Atlanta. I lived in North Carolina, and we would drive down there pretty frequently. And in fact, Atlanta, I don't remember the bar's name, but the very first gay bar I ever stepped into was Atlanta. And just so you know, there's a battle in Atlanta over who has the best hot wings. My personal opinion is it's Dugan's. I don't know if you're familiar with them. I think it's on Ponce de Leon.
I believe I've been by there. My husband and I are vegetarians, so we don't eat a lot of chicken.
Oh, man. Okay.
But I'll take your word for it.
Okay, I can't get into a chicken wing discussion with you then.
So, no, unfortunately not.
Now, was your work in El Salvador, was that much different than what you did in Atlanta and the other municipalities?
It was very similar. The State Department came down and basically asked the chief if they could borrow me, and the Hispanic liaison went down with me and helped teach that class. Obviously, we had six different Central American countries were represented there, and it was at the International Law Enforcement Academy in El Salvador. And it was the first time they had ever invited someone from a non-federal law enforcement entity into the International Law Enforcement Academy to train any class. So that was kind of a big deal in of itself. And then for it to be related to LGBT diversity and hate crimes in Central America was like literally unheard of. So there was a lot of pressure to get it right, frankly. And the main difference was I had to take something that I was cramming into basically an hour. I mean, most police officers have the attention span of gnats. I can say that because I was in law enforcement. So you got to capture the meat and potatoes really fast in a class like that. So I was doing an hour long class in service, which an hour is a pretty substantial amount of time to talk about one subject like that. Right. But I had to take that hour and expand it into 5 days of training. Right. So we got to go way farther in depth. There were parts of it. It started with a diversity piece, right? Pronoun usage, basic things that law enforcement should know when they encounter somebody, maybe a trans person, for example. But we got way farther into the weeds when it came to their main focus was the hate crimes, because LGBT hate crimes, particularly against trans women of color in those countries, is a huge, huge thing. So I spent a lot of time digging into and teaching them about the hate crime portion of it, how to identify it, what does that mean, what does it look like, how to interview the victims, get them services that they need afterwards, building rapport, that kind of thing. So that was probably the main difference, is I had a lot more time to talk to them, which was fantastic. I loved it. And so many people, the class was made up of some detectives from these different police municipalities in these six Central American countries. We had several Supreme Court judges. I remember one particularly from Jamaica named Brian. We had a good time in class. But we've got people who are sitting on the bench of the Supreme Court in these countries in my class. And they had never heard of someone being charged with a hate crime against an LGBT person. And, I had a couple of them come up to me afterwards, after class, when we focused on that. And it was really profound to me, because this is when I really thought I had made a difference, or felt like I made a difference. I remember one of the judges, she came up to me and she said, "You know what? You're a great instructor. I appreciate the information." And she said, "We can't legislate from the bench. That's not how it's set up in our country or your country." But she said, "I can certainly take those things into consideration when I am sentencing people and set a precedent that we are not going to stand for this kind of violence against this group of people." And that just really hit me, that I had the ear of a Supreme Court judge, several that were in my class, that are now going to go back and sit on the bench and remember what I said. And when they see and recognize, even though there's not a hate crimes law in their country, mm-hmm. and may never be, they're going to take that into consideration when they know that a trans woman of color was attacked or whatever happened. And they have a chance to, if they have a scale to sentence this person from 1 year to 10 years, and they sentence that person to 10 years because they recognize it was a hate crime, that's where the difference is made. So it was a pretty powerful experience. I ended up leaving that position before I got to do any of the there's other international law enforcement academies around the world. I think there's a total of four or five. But I know that the State Department has continued that training. They've taken my training course on after I left. And they've taken it to every one of the international law enforcement academies around the world. So it's literally reached all four corners of the world. And that I'm very proud of.
I'm going to take the liberty on speaking on behalf of many, many people throughout the world and say thank you.
Well, I appreciate that.
So then after El Salvador, you went to the White House. You were invited to go. tell us about that.
It was a great experience. It was directly in relation to the training that I did and the successful week-long class we had in El Salvador. The Obama administration invited me up to recognize that work and to participate in the discussion. There was probably 300 people in the room, law enforcement, LGBT folks from around the country and around the world. There was actually a trans woman that attended the class that I was in, that I taught in El Salvador. She actually was there at the White House, sitting on the panel as well, which was great to see. But it was just basically about the training. It was a discussion group about the training and how we could implement it in more places, what the training meant for law enforcement, what it meant for the community, and that kind of stuff. But it was definitely a really cool experience. And I was humbled by it, and I was very appreciative to be able to go.
Well, I have more questions, but before I forget, if anybody would like to reach you for consultation, where would they go for if a writer wants to hire your services?
They can go to my website. It's kingsharpconsulting.com. Got all the information there. It's got my contact information on there.
Okay, that's easy enough. We'll repeat that at the end. I'll also make sure I put it in the show notes. Now, a lot of our listeners are crime fiction writers. Can you tell us what mm-hmm. you can do for them as a consultant?
Well, I've done a couple of books with a couple of different authors, and the basics from them were, look, I'm writing this crime fiction work and I've never been a police officer. So I'm looking for you to go through this and look, you know, some of these get really detailed with investigations. You're chasing your characters are chasing serial killers and they're responding to police crime scenes. And you've got to put the lingo in there. You've got to get the, you know, what would a police officer call this? Would they call this a perp? Would they call this a perpetrator? You know, just little nuances that if you've never done that job, you don't know. Right. So if you've never flown an airplane, you're not going to know when the pilot may tell a co-pilot something in their lingo that you just completely wouldn't understand. Same thing with law enforcement. So I've taken the manuscripts, gone through them, and paid particular attention to the investigative details, lingo, just how cops talk to each other in a conversation. You know, they're having a dialogue between buddies at work. How does that go? What does that look like? And then obviously, you know, the details of an investigation, how it would start, where it would go, what it would look like, just to paint that realistic picture when your reader is picking up that piece of work and they're able to read that and feel like they're actually standing in that crime scene. That's what you want, obviously, in anything you read. You want to be immersed in that situation. And one of the best ways to do that is just to be true to life. You know, particularly for the LGBT twist on the whole thing, I've kind of got that. I've been doing that for 45 years. So I got a little bit of knowledge when it comes to that too. So I can merge those two together.
You did some consulting work for a writer that pretty much most of our listeners know of, John Michelson.
Yep, absolutely. I met John through the liaison program, actually. He reached out to me while I was the LGBT liaison, and he was writing at the time specifically about his story involved detectives from the Atlanta Police Department. Super, super guy and a fantastic author.
I agree with that. So, and I got to tell you, I agree with you as far as realism. You know, a lot of authors will just guess these things, and sometimes it shouts at you so much that, you know, I'm not just an author, but I'm a reader. And sometimes I have to put the book down. I can't go any further. So what you're doing is great for, hopefully, for a lot of authors out there that use your services.
Thanks.
I want to thank you again for your time. And before I let you go, I'm going to give you a chance to give us that website one more time.
It's kingsharpconsulting.com.
Well, thank you, Brian. Your story is fascinating. I wish I had another 2 hours because I'm sure we could fill it. I appreciate the time that you've given me. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, awesome, Brad. I've enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
You can find us on all major podcast applications. Be sure to subscribe to our show and not miss a single episode. Thank you for listening.